which is 9 members now, so it's a diverse fiduciary responsibility of a board, and it would move it to a single person, the governor. So we would move to what we call a single fiduciary model with full fiduciary responsibilities in line with the governor. Groom Law Firm, which is the memo that is attached here, which is on starts on page 9, talks about some of the issues relating to a single fiduciary model, especially when you have someone who isn't has multi responsibilities. Is there significant potential for conflicts of interest? You know, if you're the governor, what's good for the state of North Dakota is not necessarily in the best interest of the plan. For example, when we start talking about awarding a contract, you know, some states have a provision that 10% of contracts the state have to be awarded in state. And that's good maybe for the state, but it's not necessarily good for the plan because you're not getting necessarily the best value. You may, and if you do are, you'd select the one in state. Well, you know, as a as someone with broader responsibilities, they may have they'd be doing things that are good for the state, but then they'd be in conflict with their fiduciary role here. And then, of course, they'd be exposed to whatever legal liabilities that they have as a fiduciary for not acting in the best interest. Investing, similar things. I mean, some investment policies, and periodically in the legislature, although it hasn't been recently, there's been discussions about putting in an asset policy that says X percent of our assets need to be invested in businesses in the state of North Dakota. Those have never passed the legislature. But as a single fiduciary, you know, that type of thing could be added to the investment policies and done. It'd be good maybe for the state of North Dakota, but it wouldn't be good for the members. So what they talk here is that there's the potential conflicts that occur when you have people who have different obligations. And they go on here to list out all of the potential things, the public versus state interest versus participant interest, which is the one that I just talked about here, as you move to a single fiduciary with under an elected official like that. Competing interests from other activities. As you know, in the legislature, there is a lot of competing interests on things that should be done with the health insurance plan, that we should, you know, I remember when we went out and sought discounts for our EPO program. I mean, a lot of people came in and wanted the legislature to stop us from doing that because they thought this is not right. You know, when we put other procedures in, there's a lot of things that we affect things relating to PBMs, we affect things relating to carriers. They can be very controversial. These competing interests are there. Here again, there may be conflicts that occur. I mean, what may be good from the state perspective may not be good for the plan. Asset allocation, that there's interest there. Risks associated with current events and public sentiments. In other words, as a fiduciary, you're going to have to do things at times that are not popular. But they're in the best interest of the participants. That can be very unpopular with people. And you know when you do it that you're going to get a lot of blowback. That's not the right term. A lot of concerns. But, you know, as a fiduciary, you have to act in the best interest of the members. So you need to do those things. And so this goes on to lay out some of the things that are the dilemmas that occur when you move over to a single fiduciary. This is a major change. This is the most major change in this bill, is how the governance and the fiduciary responsibilities are going to flow. And of course, there's legal liabilities that will accrue to that single fiduciary that will be there. They go on, they talk about some of the things that have occurred where you've had single fiduciary models in part two. Part three, they identify some of the states that do have a single fiduciary model. You know, because of the limits of the time, please realize we're going to be updating this and getting more information. But as you can see here, it's not that this is unique, but it is unique in the sense that most aren't a single fiduciary underneath the governor. And keep in mind the interests of PERS. You know, PERS, there's a lot of people who say that this is a state plan. This is the state's money. Well, you know, PERS in the retirement plan, the state of North Dakota is only about half of the participants or less. All of those other people are political subdivisions. Now, you know, as a fiduciary, the governor would be responsible for the benefits of political subdivision members, as well as the state. State is only 50%. So we have a significant, and the people who oversee it right now are elected by the membership, which includes the people in those political subdivisions. We also have in the group insurance plan, you know, it's talked about, well, these are state monies. Well, yes, the state is one client in that, and I don't want to diminish that. I mean, the state is the significant client. What the state does, we do, because they are the major one. But there's political subdivision money. I mean, a lot of our participants' monies come in there. So now it would move from the trustees of the board over to the governor to determine some of those benefits for them. We have 9,000, roughly, retirees in the group health insurance plan. These people now would be under a single fiduciary, under the governor, not underneath the board that they've elected. So these monies are not just state monies. They are a broad cross-section of monies from many participants that participate in PERS. So those are some of the issues, the big issue on the governance. Moving on to Section 8 of the bill. Section 8 changes the membership on the State Investment Board. The State Investment Board is the entity that oversees they implement our asset allocation and our investment policies. Three members of the PERS board, at least have to be from the elected side, who are fiduciaries today, sit on the State Investment Board. Underneath this, they're going to move to be advisory members, so their capacity is going to be changed. They're not going to be involved in making the decisions on asset allocations. They're not going to be involved in making decisions on the details of the plan, which is one of the critical linkages as you look at it. And they will be on there, and so their role, they're no longer the primary fiduciary, they're on there. And so those linkages are all broken. It does add on the executive director of PERS, but now that would mean the executive, that since the State Investment Board oversees the teachers fund, the executive director of PERS is now going to be part of the group that oversees the teachers fund administratively, because the SIB oversees that. The teachers board administrates
I have a question there. Yes. Does that mean then that the teachers fund for retirement board would not have jurisdiction over their allocations?
No. What happens with the way it was reorganized back in 1989 is, from an administrative standpoint, the State Investment Board oversees the teachers, but they don't oversee things like the asset allocation, the governance of the plan. They aren't the fiduciaries in that sense. So from an administrative standpoint now, the PERS director would be part of that, but not part of the board. And so those are the two main changes in governance. Under access to confidential information, we did get a response on that late last night. It doesn't seem like there'll be a conflict with HIPAA on that. Under state law, confidential information, because of the way the plan is administered, would be more broadly circulated now, because there'd be more people involved in the administration of the plan. Right now, all confidential information about retirement benefits, health insurance benefits, and appeals, and all those types of things are just within the PERS office and PERS board. Now, since it would be under the governor, and the governor would be involved in administration and his staff, they would have access to that information. Legislative Employee Benefits Committee, it changes the composition of this and adds three advisory board members, not board members anymore, but advisory board members to this committee as an advisor to you. Interestingly, a lot of times we talk about encroachment on the executive branch on things. This is kind of the reverse. Now the executive branch is encroaching on to a degree on a legislative committee by putting on advisory members. I don't know that that's really significant. It's more interesting than significant in the overall plan of things. Health plan, which is Section 32 and Section 5, And if I might refer you here to the memo that starts on page 7 from Deloitte, as I mentioned, the bill itself, in terms of the way it's governed, doesn't have an actuarial impact, but these other two sections do have an effect on the plan. And what they do is that they say that the PERS board can no longer, that the PERS board cannot use the PERS reserves to help buy down the assets of the, or buy down the premiums of the plan. And as you know, in many years in the past, I mean, it goes through the legislative process, and you know, drop the template, and we put up the reserves as you directed. And so this says we can't do that. That doesn't mean that you can't come in and appropriate it. But what that does mean is that the budget before you today, in terms of the health insurance plan, provides three things. It provides for a base premium of 10.5%. It provides for a reduction in benefits, which reduces the cost, and provides for an expectation that PERS would put up 1.5% to buy down the premium. This bill would limit that. Can't do it. So that leaves three things in place. Either you would have to come in and somehow appropriate that and get it back in there. And if that doesn't occur, then we're going to have to look to cut the benefits of the plan. And if we have to cut the benefits of the plan, you know, that's going to cause us to lose grandfather status of the plan, and the co-payments and co-insurances are going to rise dramatically as a result of it. And then if you do appropriate, the other way that could occur is that instead of using reserves, you could come in and say, well, don't use reserves. We, as the employer, the state portion, we're going to increase our premium, the support, from 10.55 up to 11-something to pay for this. And that means that you'd have a $7 million, roughly, fiscal note in both general and other funds in order to do that. And so this limitation affects the either your costs, you're going to have to pay us more for the plan design that's there, or it's going to affect the plan design by causing the deductibles, mainly the deductible, to rise fairly dramatically underneath the plan. And so at a high level, these are kind of the things, and as I said, we're still reviewing this. And so, my comments today are tentative. I haven't had an opportunity. The information you're seeing just came in at the end of the day yesterday. I haven't had an opportunity to review it with my board. This is kind of an evolving situation. But in summary, the bill doesn't seem to have any actuarial impact on it. It wouldn't have any fiscal impact. In other words, it doesn't enhance any of the benefits. Doesn't make them the less. It doesn't reduce or increase our cost for administration. It doesn't really change the legislative oversight. I mean, we're still going to be reporting to you, just like we have. There was an amendment added at the end of the day in the House Appropriations yesterday that your committee would need to meet quarterly. And we report to you quarterly, but as you know, that doesn't change the reporting relationship. I mean, we continue to report to you, so this doesn't change the legislative oversight of things. And so it really narrows down to two things. I mean, there isn't any change in the actuarial stuff, no fiscal effect. There are enhancements or improvements there. There isn't any real change in the legislative oversight, how we report to you. There isn't any change in the process. I mean, we're not going to be proposing things differently. The health insurance plan is going to go the same way as it has. I mean, we'll continue to report to you like it is. There isn't any change there. So it just boils down to these two things. It's to not have PERS board act as the fiduciaries of the plan and the governing part, and put it underneath the governor. And then secondly, to put restrictions on the use of our health insurance reserves.
Okay, committee, do you have any questions of Mr. Collins? Senator Dever.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sparb, first, what you provided us seems to be an analysis. Are you considering that to be a preliminary analysis? I'm not sure what the action of this committee
is. I think that the analysis is, from our stand, is complete, but I'm just kind of reserving here that, you know, we're going to continue to go through the bill. If there's something else that comes along, we may have to supplement it. But we've gone through it in as much detail as we can at this point, given the number of days that we've had it.
And Madam Chair, if I could continue, following up on your question regarding the asset allocation determination by the TFFR board, currently in PERS, that's done by the PERS board, but then it
moved to the governor.
Moved to the individual, the governor and the executive director working together.
Well, it will move the executive director, like I serve at the pleasure of my board. So I do with my board, you know, they make the decisions, they tell me what to do, and I come and articulate those decisions to you. You know, the executive director of PERS under the governor is going to do the same thing. I mean, yes, I mean, they'll do all the day-to-day things that I do today. But, you know, when the governor says, this is what you do, this is what you do. Now, the key thing here is the fiduciary responsibility. In that particular role, if I was the executive director, I wouldn't have much concern because I'm not a fiduciary. I'd just be doing what the fiduciary tells me to do, even though it might not be in the best interest of the plan. But if the executive director was the fiduciary, then you'd have a whole conflict because, you know, the governor could tell you to do something, and as a fiduciary of the plan, it might not be what you think is in the best interest, so your obligation is to speak out against your boss. Or, if you don't, you're not acting in the best interest of your members, they could turn around potentially and sue you. And who's going to want to be held individually and personally liable for a lawsuit for, you know, something like that?
We do have questions, Senator Nelson and then Senator Kelzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sparb, a couple things. Did you make this presentation in House of Ropes?
No, there was no hearing of the bill on the amendments.
So they just accepted it and boom, this is it.
The amendments were accepted yesterday.
I got a question on Section 32. You mentioned the loss of grandfathering. What would that mean for the entire fund?
What the and keep in mind here again, this goes back to our clients. State of North Dakota is just one client in our health insurance plan. So we run grandfather plans and we run non-grandfather plans because we have both types of clients in the plan. What it means is the state of North Dakota is going to have to move over from a grandfather to a non-grandfather plan, which means they're going to have to either pay more in the premium or authorize those reserves, or we're going to have to cut benefits to get them over there. So from the plan, overall plan standpoint, again, it's just like today. I mean, today, you know, I mean, you authorized in the regular flow process like you always have what you're going to pay. And then we balance it out after you go home and what's necessary. So whatever would be happening, you lose grandfather status, we'd balance it out. What we're saying here is the only way to balance it out, if there's no additional funds to put in there or we can't use reserves, is to cut employee benefits. And so we just want that to be clear so that there's no confusion after you all go home and don't have an opportunity to deal with it, and we come along and cut benefits, and employees go, well, what's this about, and so on. I mean, we can show this was, you know, brought forward for consideration. Everybody was aware that that's what would happen. But we'd balance it out from the fund standpoint. So the fund would be whole.
Are there any legal ramifications for us losing grandfather clause?
No, it's just that you're going to have to pay more in benefits, 3% more in benefits. And you know, every time when we have to add more benefits, this is what this is the downside of it, is all of a sudden when you lose grandfathered status, we have to add in more benefits to cost 3%, which means now we're 3% farther behind than when we started off. So we have to cut benefits to in other areas to offset that 3% plus the deficiencies that's there. And that's why the size of those benefits grow so much, is because we have the two that we've got to do.
Senator Kelzer.
Madam Chairman and Sparb, is 1023 the primary funding bill for PERS?
1023 is the budget. Is it for our budget? No, in the sense that, you know, health insurance premium, I mean, you know, this again goes back to the multiple sources that support PERS. The health insurance premiums are set generally in all the agency budgets. So that's where all the money for the state employee part comes in. You know, the money for us from political subdivisions, we bill them directly. That comes in separate and distinct from, you know, your process. What we charge the 9,000 retirees, we bill them all individually, and that comes in separate and distinct. So, you know, the budget bill 1023 just deals with our administrative budget, not all of the program. All the retirement money, like say half of the money comes from you guys, the state. The other half comes from all the other participants.
Are there general funds at all in this budget?
Well, technically, no. We're all other funds, technically. And that's some of the, you know, ones from, that comes in for the retirees, the political subdivisions and things. But, you know, realistically, since the money that goes into those funds to support like a health insurance premium or the retirement benefit, they are appropriated to like the Department of Human Services and they pay it to us. So that initial amount, there's some general funds that go there. When it comes to us, it's all other funds.
Okay. And one last question, Madam Chairman.
Please continue.
Do these amendments come out of an interim committee?
No. These amendments were new as of last Friday.
Thank you.
I apologize. I should have checked to see if there was anybody from the House that was going to give us the overview of the bill and the reasons for it, but I don't know if anyone here is going to do that or not. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. That was my question. Who authored these amendments? And what was the purpose of them?
Not being in the House, I don't know. Is there anyone that knows? Representative Boehning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The amendments were brought forward to us by Representative Carlson.
Yes, Representative Gugelsberg.
Gugelsberg. Oh, much worse. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I apologize.
Representative Boehning, I guess, is the question for it. So we've got a lot of documents here about the possible concerns with this amendment. Were questions asked of Representative
Do you have
Carlson?
Your mic on, Representative?
Yep. I'll
okay.
get closer.
Thank you.
Were there questions asked of either Representative Carlson or Mr. Collins about the possible implementation concerns that we're seeing here?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gugelsberg, Representative Carlson did come in and present the amendment to us in the subcommittee.
Can you get closer to your mic also?
Well, we've been having to back up in our committee because it always squeals so much. That's why I'm sitting back further.
We had ours
adjusted. So that he came in to present and we didn't ask for any other input from the audience.
Okay. Committee, we have a decision. Is there any further questions on this bill? Oh, sorry. Representative Oban.
Oh, I don't have a question. I would like to move an unfavorable recommendation.
We have not taken jurisdiction yet, so we have to take that step first.
Okay, well, can I express a frustration that...
Absolutely.
Once again, this was heard in committee, not brought before us, acted on in committee, and I'm not sure how much one person can power play so many things. So there's my feelings on it.
Your comments are noted. Any further discussion? Then, committee, we should vote whether or not we want to take jurisdiction on this bill. So I would await a motion.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Kilzer.
I move that we do take jurisdiction on the amendments that are proposed.
Okay, we have a motion to take jurisdiction on the amendments 17.0508.01006. Pardon me?
Two amendments.
Oh, yes, that's right. And there's another amendment. That is 0.0107. So we will take both of those in this motion, if that's agreeable with the person who made the motion and the second.
It is.
Is there any discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Dever? And then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to make the observation. I think it's interesting that the Employee Benefits Committee is about to take jurisdiction of the PERS budget bill, in which the Employee Benefits Committee would become advisory. It says on page 23, well, maybe it's not the Employee Benefits. A 7-member Retirement System Advisory Board shall advise the director, the governor, and the legislative management in the administration of the public employee retirement system. So legislative management would be involved in the administration of the system. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting to me that we're voting to decide whether or not we should act in an advisory position somewhere.
I think at this point, that's our duty. And we had another comment by Representative Boehning.
Madam Chair, this was passed out of the House Committee yesterday. And so it should be getting on the calendar probably today or early tomorrow. So I don't know how we can take jurisdiction of a bill that's come out of there. And actually, the bill that should be in front of us is 1023, because that's the bill that we acted on in the House yesterday. So we can't actually, I don't think we can act. Can we act on the amendment being that's already been attached to the bill?
You raise a good point, and I initially thought we would take jurisdiction of 1023, but I may be incorrect. I'll check with the brains over on this side of the table.
Why would we take it?
Should we do take it jurisdiction of the amendment or the bill?
No, they didn't, committee.
It's rather unusual.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, so section 5435-02.4 of the Century Code states that any amendment made during a legislative session to a legislative measure affecting a public employee's retirement program, public employee's health insurance program, or public employee retirement health insurance program may not be considered by a standing committee unless it is accompanied by a report from the Employee Benefits Programs Committee. So, according to Century Code, this committee should have acted on it before it was considered
by the committee.
In practice, that's more difficult to do.
Yeah, but you're right. It's the amendment.
So, Madam Chair, it is the amendment that the committee would take jurisdiction over.
Okay. We have that clarified. It is the amendment that we would be taking jurisdiction on. So at this time and point, I would then, we should take a motion on whether or not we want to take jurisdiction on this amendment and the other amendment, 01006 and 01007. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. It sounds like the train has left the station and it really doesn't, whatever we do right now is moot.
I would agree. However, we have a duty by the rule of this committee to take an act on anything that comes before us, and this has come before us.
And we could, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
And if it should succeed in the House, we could use that as a statement in the Senate.
Yes, the report of this committee would be attached to the bill when it comes to the Senate. So, we have a motion and a second. We will call for the roll on that motion to take jurisdiction.
Senators, Chairman Kresbach.
Aye.
Dever.
Aye.
Kilzer.
Aye.
Nelson. Hoban,
yes.
Pullman. Pullman?
Aye.
Representatives Kreit, Anderson, Boehning,
no.
Doctor,
no.
Gugisberg,
yes.
Laning,
yes.
Schneider,
yes.
Madam Chair, motion carries.
Okay, we have now got the bills before this committee in our jurisdiction. So then it's up to us to give it one of the three recommendations. Before we do, though, is there anyone from the House that would like to speak on behalf of this amendment?
Well, Madam Chairman,
Representative Boehning,
as was said before, the train has left the station.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dever.
I'm curious if it would be within the authority of this committee to rule these amendments out of order pursuant to the section and require that they have a hearing in the House.
I believe we're going to have a response on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Dever, so in that same section of code under subsection 7, it states that any legislation enacted in contravention of this section is invalid and of no force and effect, and any benefits provided under such legislation must be reduced to the level current prior to enactment.
So with that, if we took no action, it could not be included. Is that what I'm understanding?
Madam
Ms.
Chairman.
Ms. Clark.
Thank you. Whether you take action as a committee is a decision of this committee.
Okay.
You can vote, one, whether to take jurisdiction. You just did vote to take jurisdiction. Now you can make a decision on whether you want to vote in favor of, in opposition of, or take no stand on. Traditionally, that's how you've acted on these. Your action in whether you're to approve it or not, you know, support it or not, will be attached to the amendment. It will not change the course of where this amendment then goes. As Alex did say, we do have subsection 7 that talks about if something's passed and it's in conflict with this process, it calls into question whether that law is valid. In practice, you as a legislative body do not tie your own hands. So if as a legislative body, a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate passes something, it has in effect overruled subsection 7. Okay. However, I think it's important to note, I would assume the legislative intent of subsection 7 is to bind yourselves to this process. The legislative body that passed subsection 7 thought it was important, and that's how they expressed that to you. So regardless of what you do today, this House Bill 1023, we're on 1023, will move forward. Your whatever motion you take should be attached, should be stapled to that bill if those amendments are passed, the amendments that you took jurisdiction over, and then it'll move forward.
Okay. Representative Doctor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Jennifer, this is the same situation that we're in with the autism bill, in essence, because we couldn't do anything with the bill here, and yesterday they reconsidered it in the House and they passed it, even though we had an unfavorable recommendation.
Right. Madam Chairman, Representative Wright, your recommendation is that it's a recommendation. It doesn't stop the process. It makes it known that there was an evaluation done. And just like that autism bill, I think the state of it as it passed out of the House yesterday is that it is a amendment, a creation of a law in 26.1, so it's only health insurance. It does not reference PERS, and it does not limit it to PERS for 2 years. It doesn't come back. It doesn't follow that health mandate protocol that's set up. So in that respect, this is a lot like that. If you as a legislative body, the House and the Senate, pass that bill without the 2 years PERS provision, by action, you have overruled what the statute says. The statute doesn't bind you. If you by a majority vote of both houses act otherwise, that is ultimately the state of the law. So, I mean, there are some parallels to that.
Okay.
But Madam Chairman.
Senator Nelson.
The difference between the two is we took jurisdiction and we acted on the autism bill.
That's right.
Before the hearing. That did not happen here.
Yes,
Madam Chairman,
Clark.
Senator, But, and you're right, there is a difference in procedurally how it took place. However, I believe that autism bill was introduced without your recommendation on it, and that in and of itself is counter to what your statute says under your committee. I mean, there are these exceptions that take place frequently, and you guys are trying your hardest to stay on top of it.
Okay, committee, we do have the bill before us, and I believe at this time and point we have to give it one of the three recommendations: favorable, unfavorable, or no recommendation. The chair would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, now that it's time.
Representative O'Ban.
I would move an unfavorable recommendation.
We have an unfavorable motion and a second. Is there any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, would you call roll for an unfavorable motion on the amendments 0.01006 and 007?
Senators Chairman Kresbach.
Aye.
Dever.
Aye.
Kilzer.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Hoban.
Yes.
Pullman.
Aye.
Representatives Kreit. Anderson.
Aye.
Boehning.
No.
Doctor.
No.
Gugisberg.
Yes.
Laning.
Yes.
Schneider.
Yes.
Madam Chair, motion carries.
The motion carries. Committee, then we will move right into the next one, and that is House Bill 1434. And Mr. Collins, once again, we will call on you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Barb Collins. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. This bill before you today was the one that was previously before you. Two things have changed in the bill that have resulted in changes to the fiscal note on the bill, and that's what I'm passing out, or is being passed out to you now. First of all, in the bill, since the last time you heard it, in under the covered benefits, the covered benefits were changed. It was changed to a tiered covered benefit, where it says coverage for applied behavioral analysis under this section must provide an annual benefit that is not less than $36,000 for people under 7, $25,000 for people ages 7 and not yet 14, and $12,000 for ages 14 and not yet 19. And that change was made in the House based upon testimony that the most value for this benefit is at the earlier ages. As a result of that change, the cost of the bill went down from what we previously had given you to $1.25 per contract per month. That was almost 50%. I think we were at $3 before. It reduced it almost by half of the cost. The other thing that occurred in the bill is that sections 2 of the bill and section 3 of the bill were eliminated on the House side. And as a result of that, the bill will now be viewed as a mandate, whereas previously when you saw the bill, it would be viewed not as it had exempted it from a mandate provision. And so now the other change in the fiscal note is that previously it was only effective for us for 2019 to 2021. The other change now is it will have an effect on us in 2017 to 2019, because that will require it to go into the PERS plan this year in this benefit. And so so those are the two primary changes that occurred in the bill since you last heard it.
Are there any comments or questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, we have a question down here.
Okay.
Since we had jurisdiction of this at one point, do we have to take jurisdiction again?
Here again, I'm informed that we should take jurisdiction on the amendments. So perhaps, do we want to do that before we discuss it? Well, let's open it up for discussion. Forget the jurisdiction at this point. Oh, we have a motion for jurisdiction on the amendments to House Bill 1434. And a second. We have a motion. Any discussion on that motion? If not, would you please call roll for us to take jurisdiction on the amendments to House Bill 1434. And I'm not too sure about their number, but they would be included in the 17.026.01001 bill.
Senators, Chairman Kurzbach.
Aye.
Dever.
Aye.
Kilzer.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Hoban.
Yes.
Pullman. Representatives Anderson.
Aye.
Boehning.
Yeah.
Doctor.
Yes.
Guggisberg.
Yes.
Laning.
Yes.
Schneider.
Yes.
Madam Chair, motion carries.
Okay, then committee, we have the bill for discussion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kilzer. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Dever. I thought.
Madam Chair, I'm a little confused with the effect of deleting Section 2. Is that, I wonder, to exempt the coverage from the requirement that apply to PERS for 2 years, or is it to say that this applies to everybody but PERS?
I would rely on counsel for advice on that.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Senator Dever. Section 2 of the bill was essentially that bootstrap in the Uniform Group Health Insurance law saying that PERS needs to do whatever the private policies need to do. Well, right now, PERS is provided through a private policy, so if 26.1 is changed, typically PERS needs to follow suit as well. However, if PERS ever goes to be self-insured, then they're not going to be bound by the mandates in Title 26.1. By removing this provision in 5452.1, if you ever go self-insured in PERS, you're not going to be required to have that provision. This provision, neither two or three really address the, does it go to PERS for 2 years and then come back and be opened up to everybody? You know, three says it's not intended to be a mandate under that whole protocol. However, what that statute says is that it's a standing committee by majority vote that gets to determine whether something is a health insurance mandate or not. And the committee that heard 1434, the standing committee, I believe, was that Representative Weiss, Human Services, they did take a vote that it was a health insurance mandate. And they did have the cost-benefit analysis performed accordingly. So.
Is that clear to all? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this will be a mandate for 2 years, is that correct? And then it's open? I'm a little cloudy on the timing there.
Madam Chairman, Representative, the state that House Bill 1434 is in, with these amendments attached to it, is that although the Standing Committee ruled that it was a health insurance mandate, by majority vote, and they did have the cost-benefit analysis performed. The way it's passing out of the House is it does not have that mandate language, sending it to PERS for 2 years. We'd actually need that language in here. We did that, I think, what's the one time we've done that, telehealth? When that bill, telehealth, came out, it did not have any law relating to 26.1 because it wasn't going to the general private market. The only language that was in that bill was the Uniform Group Health Insurance Plan. It says Uniform Group Health Insurance Plan, you need to do it for 2 years. And then there was a statement saying, and PERS come back in 2 years, and that expires in 2 years. Come back in 2 years and give us a bill and tell us about it and open it up to everybody. This bill does not have that language. This bill straight up goes to the private market for 2 years. As long as PERS receives their insurance through the private market, PERS will continue to would have that coverage. If PERS ever went to self-insurance, we wouldn't have that requirement.
Madam Chairman.
Where are you? Senator Pullman.
I believe this bill is still irresponsible, and so I would move an unfavorable recommendation.
Second.
We have a motion for an unfavorable recommendation and a second. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, excuse me, would the clerk please call roll for an unfavorable recommendation on House Bill 14, the amendments to House Bill 1434 included in .01001.
Senators, Chairman Kressbach.
Aye.
Dever.
Aye.
Kilzer.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Oban.
No.
Pullman.
Aye.
Representatives Anderson.
No.
Boehning.
No.
Doctor.
Yes.
Guckersberg.
No.
Laning.
Yes.
Schneider.
No.
Madam Chair, motion carries.
That motion carried. And I believe that concludes our work for the day. I do have a comment that I would like to make. And I find it disturbing and rather improper that there is such disregard as to the process that this committee's functions are. In other words, bills that are affecting these systems should come before this committee so that they're fully vetted before they go on to a committee hearing. So with that,
Madam Chair.
Representative Boehning.
No, just a question. We didn't take the amendments. So what happens to 1434 2000 version of the bill? Does that go to the Senate, or does it go to the Senate in a different form? I guess I'm just kind of wondering, because I know Representative Beadle will have some questions. If counsel could explain.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill will go to the Senate as it was approved by the House. There will be a report attached to the front of the bill just stating what this committee's recommendation was.
And Madam Chair, the House could bring it back for reconsideration today.
That's my understanding, too. The report would be attached to on whatever bill is passed that comes to the Senate. So with that, we are adjourned.
And that's exactly.